Hello, everybody. My name is Robin Harrison, and I'm here, as ever, with the Jose Canseco to my Mark Maguire, Mr. Ed Birkin. Ed, how are you? And that's confused you, hasn't it?
I have no idea what on earth you're on about. Jose Segredo.
Jose Canseco and Mark Maguire.
It's not music, because they're too... They sound like different nationalities, and it'd be weird to have a Mexican and an Irish lad doing a duet. So I'm honestly lost.
They were the Bash Brothers in professional baseball, and their powerful muscle-bound playing styles and forearm bashing ritual made them cultural icons of the era, though their legacies are largely tied to baseball's steroid era.
I don't know how you got down that wormhole of...
Well, famous sporting duos. Because I thought we'd start in a kind of like a World Cup type thing after the final yesterday.
Let's pretend, you know, we're current. This is going to take at least a week to go out. So I would like to congratulate Spain's, you know, victory 8 days ago. I think that's better. 10 days ago?
Yeah, that'll do.
12 days ago?
Last month.
Yeah. Why don't we just say last month, and you've got 6 weeks to get on with that, right?
Yeah, we've got a lot of time then. Last year, let's just be safe. But anyway, very pleased to welcome Jack Crabtree to the podcast from GameCheck. Now, actually, why am I going to try and do some kind of potted explanation? I'm going to ask you, Jack, to explain what GameCheck is to our listeners.
If you did an overview, Robin, someone might actually think you'd done some research into the podcast.
Oh, we couldn't have that. I don't.
It's a nice segue. It's a nice segue to get me talking as well, right? Start there. So, yeah, no, GameCheck. So I head up our sales team and our partnerships team at GameCheck. We started the business. I say we. James started the business out of the idea that when he was at NetEnt, basically the regulator was getting all shades of funny about them selling games to in Australia. And he was there going, well, we're not. And if you had no idea, and it took us a week to find out, you know, the player has got no idea that they're playing on a fake game. That's kind of where the journey started. And it's, you know, be interesting to kind of unpack that and talk more about fake games here today as well.
That's interesting. So on like, just to expand on fake games, I mean, like let's get an idea of the scale of this kind of challenge, because obviously, essentially, people are pirating slot games. That simple. Like, what's the kind of scale of this as an issue?
Oh, hang on, but before the scale, can we just clarify? These are real, so that they're pirating the kind of games, but they're real. People are still being paid out and stuff. Like, the games are still working as mechanics. They're not just kind of like taking deposits and running away. So as far as the customer is concerned, they are playing an actual game, yeah?
Yeah, so it's interesting, because there's actually sort of multiple levels of fraud here, and we only kind of focus on one, although one is kind of indicative of the other, right? Which is, it does pay out. And a fake game can be used kind of at any point. You know, it may just be a site spun up and is deciding to permanently use a fake. It might just be a site wants to pull it in when a specific player, group of players, time of day, whatever kind of comes in. But the player would have no idea that that game has been manipulated. I mean, you know, years ago, it used to be dodgy music and bad graphics, but now it's kind of, they are seamless. And in some instances, some of these houses have even hired sort of ex-provider devs to help kind of create these games as well.
Okay, that's interesting. So essentially, it's for the player, that, you know, being able to kind of like tell the difference is increasingly difficult. I mean, is it literally these people have set up like studios to pirate the games, or is it more a case of AI coming in and being used to speed up that process?
Honestly, I think it's a bit of both. You know, historically, it was pre-AI. Yeah, people were just coming in and setting it up. I think nowadays it's let's ask an LLM to do this and just say, hey, I want you to take this. Here's a game file that we've basically ripped or rebuilt, change the RTP to X. And, you know, that then allows us to kind of figure out kind of what a fake game is there. But I think AI is being used to speed it up as opposed to kind of creating the issue.
OK, and then getting back to that scale question before Ed rudely interrupted. Like, in terms of how big an issue this is, because like the example you mentioned, James, I've forgotten his surname, he works for
Elliot,
yes.
He works for Leo Vegas.
Leo Vegas, sorry. That was, well, I suppose that was like one incident that flagged them to this as a problem, but then how big actually is it?
I think it varies from not just industry, but also how at risk the player is. So, the big stat that we come out with is somewhere between 5 to 10% of the industry operates some kind of fake game, which is actually pretty sizable when you think about kind of just how big the industry is. But then that varies. So your more regulated markets targeting more kind of less at risk players are very unlikely to be targeted by a fake game. Historically, those are people you're trying to just win over. The two big places we see it are where regulation is either gray or is weak, or just non-existent. That is where they tend to be rife. The other thing is where players are being targeted who are at risk. So, a big one is sites not on BetBlocker. We did some research with the team at BetBlocker, and that's a tongue twister in a rush. And quickly realized actually most of the sites that are then being advertised are faked,
Wow.
which is a pretty harrowing kind of dark way to start the podcast. But that was a kind of big thing we found and sort of stood there going, that's fairly kind of, abhorrent when you think about it.
It's interesting because I almost kind of looked at, having kind of looked at, what Game Check does, almost kind of saw it as like a revenue protection type thing for the supply side of the industry. But I mean, it's really more, I suppose, kind of like almost like player protection.
Yeah, we kind of we're in a weird spot where we obviously are a big part of player protection, but obviously we're not a charity either, so we have to get the bills paid. And revenue protection from a supplier side is a big part of our business. But also kind of working with operators, there are a lot of operators who'll sit there and go, how come ABC Casino can offer a 200% sign up but some crazy bonus and still be profitable? And then you can sit there and go, yeah, because they're operating a fake and we can prove that. And for them, it's the ability to work with us and say they work with us helps them say, okay, yes, our competitor can give you that crazy sign up bonus. You are probably never going to get paid on it or never see much of it, and here's why. It allows us to go down that. I mean, and that actually leads me to the second part of the fraud is just because someone operates a fake doesn't mean they won't get paid. But actually, we do see an increasing, we don't work in this space, but convergence around payments fraud. You deposit the money, you're probably unlikely to get it back. There's all the other mechanisms that go behind it as well. Like you're not just going to operate a fake and kind of still go, oh yeah, no, we'll later withdraw your cash and do all this, this, and this.
So, Robin, being the journalist that you used to be before moving into the echelons of middle management, you clearly did some research. How many fake games do you think have been detected globally?
You're asking me that?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to delegate that question to Jack.
Well, if you've done your research, it's 8,500 games. It was actually in a press release they put out this morning, which also quoted H2 Gambling Capital's data. So you can tell that, they do a lot of deep research and it's a quality company.
It's actually 8,500 is interesting because we've sat on that for 2 or 3 weeks, so we're there going, and they're going, what's our actual PR approved number in the back of my head? I would sit there and go, yeah, we're going to say this publicly, but actually no, it's probably slightly higher. Yeah, interesting. We moved into Brazil and found an absolute just shitload of fakes in there.
And then what's the process for kind of verifying and re-verifying these games? Like, I'm just trying to get an idea of like the workflows, because like from the player side, it's going to, is it really a case of they need to go to the Game Check site and verify the games there? Because that feels like an additional step for that end user.
So we actually do. So we kind of, there's three ways of us detecting a fake game, and I'm going to kind of talk about how we find sites and how we evaluate them, and then kind of the player workflow afterwards. So we have a team of researchers. We work with suppliers who will typically say, hey, we suspect these sites are using fakes. Can you go and check it out for us? Or players will come to us and say, we want to know a response on this site. Historically, kind of our research team was the biggest kind of batter for that, or sort of cohort. But that's now kind of split equally between kind of players and our research team, with players taking on more of the mantle, as it was always supposed to be, as our research team is a finite resource. As more players kind of use game check, we kind of get more kind of coverage. So we were able to go out and we identify sites that way. We actually play real games and lose real money. There was an interesting thing. I know when the business was being set up and our accountant's going, you're going to have a hard time explaining company winnings to your tax authority, because it was, how do we explain this win? Although that's, interestingly, I'm not sure we've ever won anything major in all the money we've gambled, even real or fake. So we go out, we test that, we gather the evidence, and then we provide it back to the providers who tell us whether that site is real or fake. For the player, there's two ways. Firstly, increasingly, we're telling them, just look for our seal. The seal isn't there. That doesn't necessarily mean they're operating a fake, but come to our site, check it out, and we'll tell you a kind of a response. For the player, you know, the first step is obviously a lot better. The seal is there. It's a QR code. They can kind of scan it, see, like, is that a real seal as well, or has it been faked? And then coming to our site's the other one, and we can also tell whether a site's been fished as well, and we kind of let that information go up on the site. So, there's kind of a two different ways they can go to us. There's never a player having to record evidence or tell us. We kind of do that for them. Or if they find a site that we've not come across yet, we can go in and do the research fairly quickly on that.
Okay. Obviously, it sounds like a great thing, because this is clearly a huge issue in the industry. But surely players aren't going to do that. I mean, they don't even check if an operator's legal, most of them. Like, we've done surveys and things. So it's quite a lot to expect a player to even care about.
Interestingly, you're right. But actually, they do in some. I think if you're in the UK, for example, you know, I go to Betfred, and I, you know, I'm going to sit there and go, you know, they have adverts, they have shops, and they'd be pretty stupid for them to be marked with a fake. And, you know, I'm sort of calling them out. Same thing with BetVictor. They are customers of ours. And interestingly, Betfred did say that it does help them with their sort of their image and what they're trying to sort of promote. But if you're in a slightly less regulated market, they do tend to care. Especially because it's the site being legal or not. And interestingly, we sit there and go, we don't care if the site's legal or not. We care about the games being real or fake, and kind of go in from a different angle. And I think the players go, for 30 seconds, it's worth it before I deposit, you know, 100 euros or whatever kind of substantial amount of cash I want to put in there is, and realize I'm never going to get it back. And I think they use fake as almost a barometer of, it's not necessarily a real or fake game. It's actually, the site's been caught using a fake game. What else are they going to deceive me on?
Okay. If they've, so let's say the supplier finds out, you know, NetEnt, or whoever does it, you know, Rainbow Riches is being cloned and used on this site. What can they actually do about it?
So that's where we sort of started the business idea around. We thought about cease and desist, and James stood there going, okay, so I'm going to pay some lawyers a lot of money to go and target a company in Russia who is never going to respond to this letter. I finally can then go to Google or you know, Cloudflare. They take the site down and then they spin back up 3 days later. So the whole point was actually, no, the aim is not to kind of shut them down. It's to show players and to name and shame. And so at least it's less about going down the legal action, because as he said, is, you know, I'm going to pay some lawyers £20,000 to go and figure out some, get some evidence for me, and then I'm going to pay another £20,000, go through a court system. And he said, all because, you know, it's a game that we were never seeing any revenue on, and actually they were never going to buy our real games in any case. And so it was about being able to say, here's a site, you know, players can come to and see, and if there's a fake game, they're going to not play on it, and it's going to impact their revenue.
Okay, and how much kind of interaction do you have with regulators, kind of lawmakers? Because it feels like that almost feels like the missing piece of this, that kind of connection with, you know, enforcement bodies. Because ultimately, if it's kind of piracy and these are kind of, you know, like legal copyrighted products, like that feels like the way to potentially stop this.
We do work with regulators, not directly. We have no kind of commercial or even kind of legal interaction with them. But given James's kind of historical roles, we have quite a close working relationship, especially in places like the UKGC, find what we're doing really interesting. Their view on it is they wouldn't know how to regulate us as a business, because we're, right, I suppose, technically a technology partner, right? We're not we're not issuing anything gambling related, but they do use us and they do work with us on, hey, is this what's going on with this site? We want to know. But I don't think for them, it's fake games is obviously interesting to them. But actually a lot of, especially the UKGC, by the time you've gone through the rigmarole of getting a UKGC license, as we found out, is you're unlikely to be operating a fake. The other regulators also work with us as well, but it's, as we said, is they grey or black markets and kind of, operators operating illegally. For us, it's more of a, we're here to understand whether the game is real or fake, not necessarily to identify whether it's regulated or not. You know, as Ed said, is most players couldn't really care less, actually.
Right.
So, and obviously, you're not a charity. Neither am I. I don't know what Robin classes himself as. But so where's the, if you were kind of putting it there, would you say you're kind of equally split then in terms of like your customer profile between suppliers and operators? Or are you kind of more?
We're probably becoming a little more operator heavy now. In the early days, it was obviously more supplier heavy because they have a very, there's two parts to it. They have a vested interest to be able to say to the regulator, hey, that's not our game and we can prove it. And also taking action for them, it was kind of a good way for them to handle it. Now, though, with our seal sales, we are becoming more operator, kind of revenue-driven. And that was always the plan, was to be kind of work more with the operators than the suppliers. I think kind of a lot of people hold negative connotations about suppliers and the way they run the industry. And our view was actually working with the operators is getting closer to player protection and sort of counter fraud.
I was leaving space for you because I was going to ask something and then you interrupted in the last two questions.
Well, that's because mine were going to be more interesting. But come on, let's say this goal. You've had time to refine your question, think about it.
And forget what it was.
On the spot, yeah.
Is it weekends, James? Was it something like that?
What's your favourite colour?
Yeah.
That is not an easy question. What is your favourite colour, James? Jack, sorry.
Don't worry. They get that confused quite a bit. What is my favourite colour? Am I obligated to say green? You know, that game check green here? Or, you know, can I give a truthful answer?
No, give a truthful answer.
Yeah, people.
Well, you know, the bottle's blue, my mug's blue, and my laptop's blue. So, you know, I feel that there's a recurring theme there.
I think mine would have to be blue, as you say. My shirt's blue, my microphone's blue, the HG colours are blue. I support Sheffield Wednesday, who are blue, so...
Oh, you've got no hope then, there. Like, it's got to be blue.
But I am a fan of grey.
You're a fan of grey?
Big fan of grey.
Are you a millennial, Ed? Have you heard this? Like, all millennials
furnish
their like apartments and houses with grey.
My house is furnished with about 15 different colours that most people would say are off-white, but they're not. There's putty and there's all sorts of, I don't know, goose something or whatnot. Am I a millennial? Born in 84, possibly. Annoyingly.
I think you are, actually.
Yeah.
I think you do actually fall in that bucket.
Grey and orange go very well together, in my view. That was
EasyJet.
Favourite colour. Actually, shit, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? EasyJet. No, the horse
Brexit are here and here.
Damn it. And then Ryanair's blue. Oh, man, this is... What's your favourite colour, Robin?
I would probably say green. I don't really wear it, but I like the colour. Painted one room in my house, it's not some shade of off-white. That's painted green.
I actually quite like pink. Again, I don't wear pink things, but... I like pink a bit. It's a nice colour. Anyway, what was your question, Robin, before you got distracted by the rainbow?
But anyway, just on the certification, like the kind of the game check seal, you know, the kind of kite mark, I mean, what sort of uptake are you seeing in that?
Yeah, interestingly, depends on location to location, but actually fairly strong. But as you can imagine, if you're in places like Turkey or less regulated, we are a much stronger uptake. If you're in, like, the UK is still pretty strong, but nowhere near as strong on that uptake compared to those kind of greyer and blacker markets.
Okay, and then for the kind of education piece to kind of familiarise people with this symbol, I mean, like, that's obviously a bit of a challenge, you know, in this industry, because there is a lot of noise and there is a lot of, you know, like competing, you know, kind of like whether it's player protection, whether it's kind of, you know, certification, authentication. I mean, like, how are you approaching that? Do you see it as almost kind of like is there any plans to get like the certification accredited in the way you'd have like a GLI, something like that?
I think we would like to get there, but I'm not sure it's a goal of the business. I think for us, it's the win would be not necessarily some formal body saying, hey, you're accredited. It's actually more of a, every player is going, we don't see your seal, so we don't trust your site. That's the kind of ultimate goal. And I think that's reflected as a business. We hold the attitude of, you know, we want to work with accreditation and regulation bodies, but actually we're not that fussed if they turn around and say, hey, we just don't know how to regulate you, so we're not. You know, we're still going to do the work and protect the player, and that's been our kind of primary goal from day one.
Okay, and you've mentioned this a few times now. It's like whether it was a gambling commission or with the kind of like certification houses, people aren't really sure how to regulate game check. I mean, is that a risk? Because essentially you're potentially different things to different people, and you know, how do you
they
kind of
be regulated? They do you, then when
well, no, it's not so, it's not so much about being regulated and actively seeking out, you know, kind of like some form of regulatory framework, but in terms of like the use case and how it fits in, you know, kind of like to the industry to get it embedded. I mean, like, is that, it's almost like having that sort of slightly hazy identity. How do you kind of nail that down?
I get where you're coming from. I don't think they do, because I think actually, you know, if you're, the main thing we focus on is working, you know, with operators. So operators have a pretty good understanding about what we do. You know, if we, it's not the, you know, we don't want to be regulated. I come from payments initially. And when the Open Banking Initiative came out, loads of like regulators said, we just, you know, we were before Open Banking as well. They just went, it's not that we don't want to work with you. We just have no idea how to regulate you. And therefore just keep doing what you're doing and like go away. And so, you know, in the US, it was a very different framework. It was, no, we're happy to regulate you, and here's the framework. Whereas in the UK, it was very, we don't really, you know, this is before open banking came into effect and PSD2, and it was, we actually don't know how to regulate you. So, you know, as long as you're not doing these activities, we're not that fast. And I think we're in the same position here, which is, it's not that they don't want to or we wouldn't want to. It's just, you know, you guys are doing good work. We don't feel that there's any risk to players in the activities you're doing, so actually, you know, I mean, I've not even been in those conversations. I just have to assume that's what they're saying. And it's a, and if they wanted to kind of regulate us, we would, but it's kind of a, you know, we're doing our thing, and you know, come and reach out if you've got any questions.
Okay. And
testing labs aren't regulated, are they? I mean, they probably are in the US.
No. Oh, they probably, yeah, in the US they probably are, because everything's regulated there.
Yeah, I think in the US they have to be registered as some kind of sort of, like, you know, service provider. Yeah, there's some kind of, like, ancillary service provider. Yeah, yeah, they have some kind of accreditation. But, I mean, like, the testing houses, they kind of, they do exist in a bit of an odd kind of nether zone between, you know, kind of in terms of the, they create these standards and then they impose these standards, which I'm
I think it's because they're a, you know, they're not, it's a, you don't, you're not actually, you're not interacting with the player. You're not doing any sort of gambling over here. So the view is that, well, like, well, how do we regulate this? Whereas in the US, yeah, I think they do have ancillary service providers and, you know, it's very sort of, well, actually kind of you are interacting through third parties and therefore.
Hmm. And then just kind of one thing that comes to mind, like on, like, you know, say these people are using these fake games. I mean, like, is there any sort of meaningful revenue leakage, like, from the studios? Because obviously at the moment, you know, a lot of the things that we're hearing is that studios are in a difficult position. You know, margins are getting squeezed. There's just a stupid amount of content hitting the market each month.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, is there any kind of, like, just in terms of kind of, what are they kind of potentially losing out on?
Yeah, I mean, they are getting squeezed pretty hard, those studios, from this leakage. I mean, was it the CEO of Evolution turned around and said a couple of months ago, basically blamed one of the single biggest revenue leakages in their company was people copying their games and pirating them. And I think the argument they're saying there is, yeah, the player sees an RTP of, I'm making this up, 50%, right? But actually Evolution sees 100%, sorry, a 0% RTP, because they're not seeing a penny of that sort of revenue coming their way. You know, I think the world sort of, I think it's tricky because it's kind of, on the one hand, their games are getting cloned and they're sort of complaining about their bottom line. At the same time, I'm not sure anyone's got any sympathy for them. But yeah, we do see a huge amount of leakage from their, through fake games being faked. And yeah, we could infer some revenue stats there, but I'd be kind of uncomfortable to do that publicly.
Fair enough.
Because it would be an inference, right? I'd be going, well, based on Evolution's, like, money that they make and, you know, 5 to 10%, then we have to assume, and it would be a no.
Okay. And then actually with these games, I mean, like, are they kind of, like, I'm just thinking about that kind of leakage. I mean, like, are these kind of, like, fake or pirated titles offered through just directly on the site, or do you see them kind of popping up in, like, aggregated like, you know, aggregation
Yeah,
platforms. Because I'm just interested in the distribution.
I think historically, you know, we saw aggregators getting kind of the cam for it. And I think what was happening is the aggregator was coming in and selling their suite of games. And then someone was kind of, actually, interestingly, someone DM'd James and on WhatsApp, and he's there going, I'm the chief legal officer of LeoVegas, or, you know, the director of legal. And I run a company designed to eradicate what you guys do. Like, really? But yeah, no, they kind of pop up on the side. And I think historically, some aggregators probably have been a bit naughty, but I think a lot of them have just been kind of carrying the flak because it's been an easy kind of, you know, oh, we'll just blame aggregator A, B, or C, and then we won't actually kind of admit to the fact that it was someone else. And, you know, it was, oh, this aggregator sold us the games. We're really sorry, because it's much easier to kind of blame them than actually admit that, yeah, some shady guy on WhatsApp approached me and I took their games.
And can it be used the other way around by regulators to enforce against legitimate suppliers? So, you know, if you are a supplier and the regulators are going, oh, hang on, you're supplying a lot of unlicensed websites in our country, and they go, oh no, we're not really, they must just be copies of our games. You can go on there and go, and they go, you know, they speak to James or yourself, and they're like, hey, you know, so and so said that these are copies. Are they real games? You can go on there and go, no, they're real games.
It would be, so technically, I mean, there is a technical answer to say yes, but we would be working with the provider, right? So we would have to go back to the provider and say, you know, we found this site in, I'm making this up, let's, you know, Argentina or Spain, right, based on the World Cup final, but, you know, we found this site here, could you verify? And they'll quickly put two and two together of who approached us and asked us to do that, right? Because they'll be there going, well, the regulator just approached us saying, we found this game, is it yours? And then we would be going back saying, hey, could you just verify this evidence? And I think anyone, any of those teams would sit there and go, yeah, we know that, like, the regulator's tasked you to do that. And I mean, we would also sit there and say, you know, you would need to go back to the provider as well. We can't validate. We need the provider to tell us whether that game's real or fake, and we would just say that you need to go back to them. Unfortunately, there's nothing we could do around that, because the whole point is we need to be beyond, like, it needs to be defensible. And if we were just kind of saying, you know, this URL typically is associated with fake games, you know, we would be putting a lot of liability on the table, which we wouldn't want to do. We want to be sure that it's a fake, and therefore only the provider can tell us.
Okay. And then, do you feel that you're almost kind of filling a gap? Because obviously, supplier licensing is kind of, you know, gradually starting to kind of appear. And it's like, yeah, well, I mean, like when you think about supplier licensing, for the most part, it's going to be, you know, where games are kind of, you know, legally available. Are they legal, you know, are they in a country that they shouldn't be? But they're, you know, this kind of almost feels like it could form part of that, like, you know, being able to kind of like verify, make sure people are running genuine games.
I think, yeah, running genuine games and part of it would be a good one. And we are speaking with some markets that we sort of lovingly call pre-regulated. And we're not talking about the grey market there. We're talking about countries where they're building regulation to kind of come in. And they want to make it part of that suite as a, actually, you know, you're going to do the testing house, but then also if GameCheck flags you with a fake and you don't have their seal, you know, if you don't have their seal and you are caught with a fake game, then we're going to kind of have a conversation about your overall licensing. We think, and actually, I do think, oh, I mean, I'm going to say this right. We think that's a pretty strong approach as well. I would say that when I think about kind of some of these regulated markets, though, it's the license is more than that, and it's also about the player protection. Yeah, we are just a part of it, and kind of protecting the player is part of it. It's not just the, you know, what services are available when, so for people to signpost to when they think they've gone too much, and how do you protect players from over gambling and so on and so forth.
It's interesting.
But,
not as interesting as finding out your favourite colour's green, which is pretty weird, if I'm honest. Well, I know you're a Celtic fan, but still. Is that actually it? Is that the only reason?
No, well, I mean, I suppose, you know, growing up, I saw a lot of green stuff because of that, but
Well, I
so it's
mean,
quite.
you're in Glasgow, so you didn't see that much grass or anything, did you?
We have
Wouldn't class
grass.
Glasgow as being green.
Well, I mean, we have grass. It's kind of
Okay.
it was well back then. It was mainly kind of brown and dead, you know. Like, also a lot of orange. You know, the old kind of like blaze pitches. Playing football, there was a lot of that.
Last I was in Glasgow, it was quite a good city, actually. Obviously, the centre. I've not been to the outskirts of it.
Oh no, it's got really nice now. Like, it's
Yeah.
definitely it's definitely kind of picking up. They've got an Aesop now.
Yeah, yeah. I was in the Accenture office and I was there going, this is nicer than parts of London.
Oh, yeah.
And they're all there going, but you're in Glasgow. And it's one, and I'm there going, no, this is actually quite nice, guys.
Yeah, no, Glasgow, like, genuinely, it's I don't go back that much. When I do, it does kind of amaze me how different it is.
Yeah. We were in a really nice bar entertaining, and you got to the bill, and I was there going, there's no way it was this cheap. The London of me was going, I'd have spent $2,000-$3,000 sort of hosting this event here, and it was under £1,000, and this was pre-pandemic, but I was going, there's no way it's this cheap.
Well, I haven't been for 15 years, but I got a cab from the train station to the hotel, and I asked the cab driver about, you know, where to kind of go out for dinner and stuff, and he just said he wouldn't recommend me leaving the hotel.
Sorry. Yeah, but that's more about your, that's more about your personality than anything else. Because people in Glasgow, it's like, I don't think people are particularly, I think people are very welcoming, but it's kind of it's probably in quite a kind of aggressive way. Like, you kind of feel that if they decide to talk,
aggressive way.
Yeah, you can, like, if someone decides to talk to you, they are going to talk to you. It doesn't matter what you're doing or where you are. If they decide to talk to you, they will fucking talk to you.
that was really threatening. That was that they will fucking talk to you. you will have a conversation.
Oh, it's where you meet all the best people, you know. Actually, no, I better not tell that story in the podcast. I think we've kind of exhausted every avenue. So, Jack, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, guys.
I've enjoyed this. And also, I mean, I think these things, it's like, I think sometimes, like, some podcasts, you know, when you kind of have, like, I mean, it's, but well, I mean, it's like, yeah, structure, kind of like questions, kind of like discussing a product. Yeah, it's just like, it's no fun. It's nice just kind of having stuff come into our heads and then us seeing it.
It's also interesting because where we sit, we sort of, I get quite frustrated when we sit there in the player protection racket and they're going, no, we're going to talk about the black market versus not. And I'm like, oh my God, the black market is not your biggest problem right now. Like, we found regulated sites operating a fake. Like, and actually we have seen many unregulated site actually behave like a regulated site. They're just in a black market territory, not operate a fake. Like, I think we need to kind of have that conversation in another dimension now. Like, what is putting players at risk? And, you know, it is like I started with bet blockers, and I was researching sites not on bet blocker, predominantly operating a fake, is tells me where the biggest problem is.
Yeah. All right. Well, everyone, thank you very much for listening. This has been another episode of Right to the Source, and we'll see you in the next one. See the shit I have to deal with.
He-Man.
It's gaming, He-Man. Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, He-Man was, I think when I was younger, I did actually have a little He-Man toy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you know remember who the baddie was?
Skeletor.
Oh, yeah. Who's She-Ra?
She was a offshoot character. Okay. I think she might have had her own series, but...
Oh, what was the lion that he rode on? Or his friend?
It was a tiger.
Tiger, wasn't it?
Are you sure you didn't have My Little Ponies? Because your knowledge of He-Man is disturbingly limited.
What was it called, the tiger?
Cringer. And then it turned into Battle Cat. Yeah.
It wasn't... Was that the one with Snarf? Snarf!
No, you're thinking of Thundercats.
Ah, that's the one.
Yeah.
That's the one, Thundercats. That was She-Ra, Thundercats.
No, it wasn't. She was definitely a He-Man offshoot.
Ah.
We should probably start at some point. Yeah.
I was going to say...
Hang on.
I feel like we can keep going here.
Yeah, no.
I mean, this is the sort of stuff we usually talk about on the podcast.
I'm thinking of She-Ra, the Princess of Power, He-Man's twin sister. There you go.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know that.
See, why did we stop talking about this before the podcast stopped? You can add this stuff in.
Well, this is recording.
It's recording. No, this is good. So She-Ra was twin sister of He-Man. But Thundercats I was more of a Thundercats person, if I'm honest. What about you, Jack? Thundercats, My Little Ponies, or He-Man?
I have a brother who's 6 years older than me, so he sort of dictated that. I was saying to my dad the other day, because that's sort of my birthday. And he was like, you know, what was the first video game you played? And I was like, I remember my brother showing me Resident Evil at 4. That was fun. And like, you could see my parents' colour just draining as it. You know, that was an interesting experience for me.
Well,
nightmares for a month for that one.
Well, I mean, we seem to have started the podcast, but Robin hasn't even introduced you or us.
No, and I'm going to do all that in a minute. But I think
you're going to kind of try and slice it and put it in the right chronological order.
Well, I'm not. I mean, this is why we have Tom, the editor, who's outstanding at this kind of stuff.
Who likes to censor everything I say that isn't.
Well, yeah. Yeah, we ask him to bleep all your swear words.
Yeah, apparently you can't say shit.